Today we're talking about Freejack, the 1992 time travel body snatching dystopia set in the futuristic hellscape of the year 2009. A film whose predictions about the future of the United States included FaceTime and a shotgun-wielding nun. So basically, they were two for two. That's coming up on Uncharted Space. Hello and welcome to Uncharted Space. I'm Craig.
And I'm Josh.
And each week we talk about a science fiction property that has had a profound impact on one of us and that the other has never seen.
What are we talking about today, Craig?
Well, today we're talking about the film Freejack, which I believe came out in 1992? You have a computer there, is that right? 92?
I do have a computer here. Do you want me to look it up?
Yeah, sure.
1992.
Okay.
The only thing that I remember about the existence of this film is the poster looked like the poster for Tron, but with the guy from the Mighty Ducks on it.
What does the movie poster for Tron look like? He's just standing holding the thing up in the original? Is that the...
Well, I'm comparing that movie poster from Freejack to the visual themes that I recall from the 80s Tron.
I'll tell you what I love about this moment is I can't see what you're seeing, but neither can anyone else listening to this. And so this really is a true aural moment that we're experiencing.
So the Freejack poster has...
Oh, yes. Explain it. This is great.
Two grids that are like neon blue, like a blue to purple gradient that are fading away into the background.
Okay.
And then superimposed over... those grids are the faces of one Mick Jagger.
Yes.
One Emilio Estevez.
Sure.
And one Hannibal Lecter.
Rene Russo doesn't make it to the poster?
Not this one.
Oh. And Anthony Hopkins was, I think, coming a year off of that Oscar and just cashing all the checks that were offered to him.
Does he mention fava beans at all in the movie Freejack?
There's no fava beans, and it was probably a sweet gig for him. He probably filmed 2 days because he's on like one location and then he's on like a computer screen.
Hi, Jewel. How'd it go?
Fun and games. I didn't make any friends, but I made a deal.
Good. That's good.
Where are you?
I'm in Sydney. I wanted to be near the opera for when the fat lady sings.
Like a FaceTime. FaceTime is really the only aspect of the future that they got right. This film is set in 1992, but they jump ahead in time to the dystopian future of 2017, if I'm not mistaken.
Wikipedia, which I'm now looking at, says 2009.
Oh, 2009. So basically, they take us to a year after the iPhone came out, and there is FaceTime, but only in cars, not in handheld devices. And it is interesting how much you see fears of the 80s, the way we were killing the world in the 80s as opposed to now, because, of course, at that time, we were destroying the ozone layer, and we're actually very successful at stopping that, which is great. But that becomes a plot point about in the future. But do you want to know what this movie's about, Josh?
I do.
Okay. Emilio Estevez is a hotshot race car driver. He's got the big race coming up.
Aren't you a little bit nervous?
Nervous? No. I've seen it all in advance. Vroom, checkered flag. Vroom, honeymoon in the Bahamas.
Listen, let's just take one zoom at a time.
I'll win that race, honey. You watch. There ain't no one out there that can stop me.
But set against this race, we see this strange figure in a tank, which is Mick Jagger. These two scenes are going in tandem. Well, Emilio Estevez ends up getting a car accident, a horrible car accident through some original native advertising over, I think it's a Nissan or Toyota track, which doesn't seem like good native advertising if you think about it, that you'd want your car brand associated with a fiery car crash. But
this is like Mr. Big dying on a Peloton.
Yes, exactly. Yes. They didn't read the script, I don't think.
Also, Mr. Big is the band that sang To Be With You. I'm the one who wants to be with you. I think, believe the Sex and the City character was just named Big.
Yes, it was Big. Okay.
Did you know that Paul Gilbert, the guitarist from the band Mr. Big's son, goes to my son's school?
Do you know that I don't know what the band Mr. Big's is?
The fact that he called them Mr. Biggs corroborates that claim. Let's get back to the film.
Sure. So this mysterious figure in the tank, played by Mick Jagger, as you pointed out, he is transporting Emilio Estevez's body a moment before he's going to die into the future. And why is he doing that? Well, he's doing that because there is a wealthy person who's paid to have their mind downloaded into this fresh body, but Emilio Estevez escapes, and the movie is basically Mick Jagger chasing him, trying to find him so that the wealthy patron can put his mind into him. Now, you may be asking me, Josh, why, if you have the technology to put somebody's brain in somebody's body and you have time travel technology, which is pretty incredible, why do you have to pull people from 1992?
You're right. That's exactly what I was going to ask you.
Mm-hmm. Well, the reason that you're pulling them from the past is because the ozone's gone.
I don't get it. Why me? Why don't they just grab somebody who's alive now?
Take a look at these people, Alex. They've lived half their lives with no ozone layer. Sucking up mega doses of carbon monoxide, sulfur dioxide, mercury, lead, benzene, nuclear waste. Most of them are hooked on drugs that weren't even around in the 20th century. Let's face it, you're a hot property, my boy.
So you want a good fresh 90s body.
Some real high concept shit.
Well, here's the thing. It's based on a novel that's super high concept about, in the future, the existence of the afterlife is proven. And in addition to that, I haven't read the novel, but in addition to that, there's also vampires and werewolves and ghosts and basically every supernatural thing. And because people know exactly what happens when you die, life becomes meaningless. And well, as I said, I haven't read the novel, but
that sounds like some like accurate but clunky philosophy.
Accurate but clunky philosophy. Yeah. So this film ends up cutting most of that out because the producers wanted to make an Arnold Schwarzenegger film. And the guy who directed it was coming off of Young Guns 2, which he made with very little studio supervision because they were in the midst of making Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. And he thought he was going to go into Free Jack with little supervision, but that was not the case. And
he got notes.
Yeah, he got notes. And basically, instead of being a really strange science fiction thing, I mean, there are these two big elements of time travel and body swapping, but most of it ends up just being a chase movie.
I have many questions, Craig.
Yeah, let's do it.
My first question, Mick Jagger?
The first line of the film is, "All right, let's do it." I think I got that just about right. I think I got that about right.
That was not bad.
Okay, let's do it.
So he's not officially playing himself, I take it.
No, he's playing a hunter in the dystopian 2009 hunting Free Jacks down. And he very early gets fired because Emilio Estevez runs away. And he's fired by Jonathan Banks, who people will know as Mike Ehrmantraut from Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That guy.
You are slipping, Victor. You are contracted to deliver Furlong. I see you, but I do not see him.
Beautiful. Fabergé.
There was no delivery. There will be no payment. Now get out of my sight.
Mr. Vesendak is leaving now. He is no longer on this case.
Let me tell you something. I said I'd deliver Furlong, and that's what I'll do.
Why, Victor? Who do you think you're talking to?
An asshole.
Get out!
It's got a great cast. Mick Jagger's number two is played by Isai Morales, who people know from Mi Familia or more recently Ozark, the villain of the first season.
Know anyone indulging in a little commerce on the side, River?
I don't, but it's worth checking.
Sure is. Step up.
Come on, Victor. 12-13-27-51306. I never have, nor will I ever, divulge information outside of this organization to anyone. Frankly, I'm surprised you would even test me.
I'm not testing you, Ripper. I'm testing the machine. And it works. Have the others tested.
So this is a time travel body snatching movie.
It is a time travel body snatching movie, yes.
The first thing that came to mind, although this isn't so much about body snatching, is the film Looper. Do you think that Looper, which is definitely a movie about weird dystopian time travel shit.
Uh-huh.
Do you think Free Jack walked so that Looper could run?
I would say that as a 10-year-old watching Free Jack, it affected me the same way that being however old I was when Looper came out was watching that, where it, to be clear, the effect that Free Jack would have on you watching it today as an adult is not the effect it had on me as a 10-year-old. But that is, I would say, that the effect Looper had, you know, that's just kind of very, well, existential and depressing sort of pit that you get after watching it.
So to give folks a small peek behind the pod.
Oh, let's peek.
When we first started talking about doing an episode on the movie Free Jack, you had not seen it in many years and you remembered it glowingly.
I don't know that I would say glowingly. It was an important movie in my life. I was 10 years old. My parents had just gotten a divorce. I was watching it with my soon-to-be stepfather. There was a lot of change going on in my life, and it was an inflection point where something about this film, and I don't know if it was the body snatching or the, you know, the idea of like seeing somebody disembodied waiting for their mind to either go somewhere or nowhere, that really, like, for the first time, like, not just the idea of death generally, but the idea of my death specifically, like, really hit me after watching this movie as a 10-year-old. And it had a very dark effect. It was profound. It was not pleasant. It was deeply unsettling. And I would say watching it many years later, it was a fun romp. So, yeah.
Well, holy shit. I mean, it's not every day that you get to talk about the film that first made you face the reality of your own mortality.
Yeah.
That's wild, man.
It's wild. And I think there's a lot of elements in this movie that even though the execution is not as impactful to an adult as it was to a child, I definitely see like those interests drawing a line through the type of things I gravitated to as I got older, the type of stories I was interested in telling. It was an impactful movie, for better or worse.
One of the things you started to touch on at the beginning and something that I wanted to ask you about this movie, which is made in 1992 and set in 2009.
Yes.
Is that an issue? I mean, I would almost call like near future dystopian, like a genre.
Mm-hmm.
And a common problem with near future dystopian stuff is that they cut it way too close. And that by setting it in such a close future, they're not setting the movie up to stand the test of time.
One thing that's interesting, though, as we mentioned, like, this is the one ecological problem that we all got together and solved. Like, hey, let's stop using the products that kill the ozone. Great. If we hadn't done that, maybe the world of Free Jack would have come to pass. Who knows? It is a bit of a leap, though, to say that within 18 years, you could come up with both time travel and body brain moving. I should note that the novel takes place, I think, like 1,000 years in the future or something like that, at least many hundred. So the novel, which I think was written in the 1950s, has a very plausible jump in time. One of the things that's intriguing comparing it to how this movie might be made today, we're so obsessed today, I think, because we have the de-aging technology with, like, if you have an actor who's in a flashback scene or whatever, you have to de-age the face, not just the dramatic, like, you know, the most recent Indiana Jones movies, but in general, just like little things. Whereas like it used to be, you just slapped a black wig on them. We understand that the actor is the age they are. And you know, we went with it. Maybe you softened the focus or something. In this movie, Renee Russo plays the girlfriend of Emilio Estevez, later a high-ranking corporate wheeler dealer. And she's 18 years older from the first timeline to the second timeline, and they didn't really do any aging makeup, which I think is cool, because, you know, it's as you get older, you realize, yeah, you kind of look about the same from, you know, 25 to 50, you know?
I mean, Renee Russo has the added benefit of already being a mega babe.
I thought you were going to say she has the added benefit of being Renee Russo, but same sentiment, different sentence.
I have a life here, Alex. I can't just walk away from it.
What about us?
Us was 18 years ago.
It was 2 days for me.
So I'm actually curious, and we could only speculate, but...
We can only speculate.
I'm curious about the decision of the film producers to set it in the near future as opposed to the far future as it is in the book. And I'm wondering if a lot of that had to do with just the impracticality of doing the amount of world building you would need to do to create a believable 1,000 years in the future setting within a 2-hour movie in a way that you probably can in a 500-page novel.
Well, I mean, the thing is, they do jump forward quite a bit. I mean, in terms of like the way the culture has changed, and not just these two technology things, but New York basically looks like Mad Max. I think the whole thing is, if not entirely, mostly on a back lot. There's extremely impoverished sections and chaos, and then the, you know, what they envision for the giant skyscrapers, what they end up being. So most of the sets are built, but I imagine that it probably is just the fact that the way the story got conceived, they wanted Rene Russo's character to still be there. And the reason why Emilio Estevez is being snatched is, spoiler alert, the guy who's doing it has the hots for Rene Russo and is thinking that if he can come to her in this body, then she will accept him.
It wasn't because he wanted him to come coach his terrible but endearing youth hockey team.
You know, it may have been, and that might have been the sequel that was scrapped. I don't know.
I love to keep coming back to Mick Jagger.
Who would?
Because his presence in a film like this is such an enigma to me. How heavily does the Mick Jagger character play in the film?
Heavy. It's a cat and mouse movie, and he is the cat.
Why didn't you kill me when you had the chance?
I was aiming at you. They were in the way.
Well, they're not now.
You're right. Tell me who's behind all this. Who told you I'd be here?
I'm sorry, but I can't tell you that.
His face isn't just on the poster because he's a big name. He's a going concern.
Yes, he's tossing Fabergé eggs like they're nothing, and yeah.
You said that upon rewatch, you found it to be a fun romp. Is that the term you used?
Yes, camp might be another way to put it.
Did it lose all of the existential weight that it had for you when you watched it as a kid? Or was there anything of substance still in it for you when you watched it as a man of a certain age?
I don't know if it lost its existential weight, but I think the existential weight that I'm carrying on a day-to-day basis is so heavy that the addition of it was not substantial enough to funk my mood, let's say.
It's pretty hard to make a dystopian thing that makes me feel feelings these days.
We all live in a dystopian nightmare of our own, don't we?
We sure do. From my extremely unthorough research.
We can talk more about Mick Jagger. It's fine. Let's do 99 questions about Mick. Let's get into it.
What? Silence of the Lambs was a year before this movie. I take it nobody in their right mind would let a 9-year-old watch Silence of the Lambs.
I didn't see Silence of the Lambs until many years later. That's true.
Almost certainly for the best.
I'll bet we know people who saw it when it came out, though. I'll bet you.
Anthony Hopkins was nominated for or won an Oscar for his portrayal of Hannibal Lecter. Yes?
I'm quite sure he won, sir.
Right.
For, I think it's 12 minutes of screen time.
Oh, is it really that little?
But the scenes are spliced throughout the whole movie. I mean, listen, like the movie Free Jack, Anthony Hopkins leaves a big impression for a small amount of weight.
Yeah, he really fucked my shit up when I saw that movie.
Mind the drawings, please.
But what I'm curious about is, coming off such a weighty role, and I think you started to touch on this earlier, Hopkins was playing this terrifying and complicated, multifaceted character in Silence of the Lambs. Did his character matter in this movie at all?
Well, do you want a spoiler, Josh?
I'll take a small spoiler.
He has died. He's in the spiritual switchboard, and we see Anthony Hopkins talking to Rene Russo on a screen, which he's either pre-recorded it or it's not quite clear the technology of that. And then the climactic moment of the movie is whether or not Emilio is going to be overwritten by Sir Tony.
I just had a very interesting thought, at least interesting to me.
Yeah.
Maybe it'll be interesting to you too. this, what did you call it? The ethereal switchboard?
I think it's the spiritual switchboard.
The spiritual switchboard, and the idea of people's consciousnesses living in this sort of like technological limbo.
But only for like 3 days, and then they kind of dissipate.
This is a theme that is used heavily in the television program Westworld, which also stars one Sir Anthony Hopkins.
We can't define consciousness because consciousness does not exist. Humans fancy that there's something special about the way we perceive the world, and yet we live in loops as tight and as closed as the hosts do. Seldom questioning our choices, content for the most part to be told what to do next.
Can I tell you who else is in this movie, Josh?
Who else?
Amanda Plummer.
Oh, no shit.
Yes, playing a nun with a shotgun.
If you're a praying man, I'd start.
Look, sister.
Don't sister me. Get the hell up. What are you and what are you doing here?
What is it that they call me?
Pathetic?
No. A free jack.
Oh, holy shit.
The daughter of Christopher Plummer.
The daughter of Christopher Plummer.
The lady that screamed all the shit in Pulp Fiction.
That screamed all the shit in Pulp Fiction.
And who played one of the most compelling villains of this decade in the third season of Star Trek Picard.
Absolutely.
My favorite thing about it was that every time her ship showed up, it played this... Bwah.
Sirs, contact the Shrike.
Yes.
Sound effects. Yes. And it never got old.
It was the Inception ship.
It was very much an Inception sound effect. Like, they took it right off of Hans Zimmer's keyboard.
Was there not a moment of you being excited with your affinity for Star Trek VI that you had both Christopher Plummer and Amanda Plummer being two of the most iconic villains in all of Star Trek history?
Yes, that fact was not lost on me. I seriously love Amanda Plummer.
There's nothing not to love.
Well, Craig, if nothing else for the presence of both Mick Jagger and Amanda Plummer in this movie, I think I'm ready to watch it.
Take a dive, Josh. Take a deep dive.
We'll see you next time on Uncharted Space.
Which aspect of Star Trek was your entryway in?
Star Trek The Next Generation when I was a kid. I started watching it with my dad, actually, when I was probably like 6.
That's pretty badass. For me, it was the films. I think around the time that I watched Free Jack, actually.
I don't remember a ton about watching Star Trek when I was a little kid, but I do remember that I was terrified of the Borg. Like, to the point where I would, like, leave the room mid-episode.